we're seeing now, the data is very clear. Most projections put 50% of the U.S. workforce being remote by 2027. So this is definitely starting to ratchet up. Currently, right now, it's about 8% of the U.S. workforce. So it's going to ratchet up very quickly.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Liam Martin. Liam is the co-founder of Staff.com and TimeDoctor.com. Combined, they have 40-plus employees in 9 different countries. Staff.com specializes in remote, long-term employee management. I think of it like Upwork, but for long-term work. Liam also runs the Running Remote Conference. That's the world's largest remote conference. It's specifically designed for building remote teams. Liam has had the opportunity to build a remote team and talk to lots of folks who are just starting out. He has great advice on how to convert from co-located to remote and also what to look for in that very first remote hire. And now, here's my conversation with Liam Martin. Liam, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks for having me.
What is the biggest inflection point in your career that's gotten you to where you are today?
It was probably partnering up with my now co-founder of the last 8 years, Rob. So me and Rob are very different personality types. And what Rob was teaching me was discipline as it applies to one singular thing. So before that point, I was definitely working on a lot of different projects. And when I started working with Rob, we both signed a contract when we founded the company saying that we were going to work 30 hours a week, every week, on one project, which was Time Doctor. And if we worked under that amount of time, we could both trigger the ability to have our shares suffer on both sides.
Interesting.
And that allowed me to really focus on one singular thing. I get distracted very, very easily, which is why even today, I think very directly and insightfully about trying to start something new. I think entrepreneurship is really more a question of what do you not do as opposed to what do you do.
And what's your thought process? You see a juicy new opportunity or product idea, and how do you know if that's the thing that'll be the next thing, or if that's, you know, something to lay to the side and focus on Time Doctor?
A perfect example is there is a space right now for payments for remote employees. There will be a Workday for remote work, and that company will be worth probably more than Workday within the next 10 years. Someone will build that company and will probably have a massive, massive company. And we looked at it about a year and a half ago and said to ourselves, do we want to try to build something like that? And we realized that the answer was no, we don't want to build something like that because of a whole bunch of factors that we probably shouldn't get into necessarily right now. But it's choosing something that you can win at and something that is not going to distract you from your current focus in something that is kind of almost digestible necessarily. That's the way that we look at things. So as an example, our conference Running Remote, which is a conference for building and scaling remote teams, we realized there weren't many conferences like this out there. There was a hole in the market for this type of conference to exist. And we also knew that with a couple $100,000 invested, we could completely go after that entire market and digest it properly. As opposed to payroll for remote teams, it's probably, I mean, the companies that are doing this right now are doing $20 to $50 million seed rounds. So there's a lot of dollars that go into it. And we generally don't like to go venture-backed simply because venture doesn't really like remote teams.
That has been my experience. I think that's changing slowly. So I'd love to dive into this Workday example. So my impression of Workday is big enterprise HR thing that nobody likes, but lots of enterprise companies buy. What is so different about remote work that it requires a different big enterprise HRIS type thing?
So right now, large companies have a significant resistance against remote work. And there are two important questions that pop up when someone wants to work remotely, when a company wants to work remotely, which is, how do I know what they're doing? Time Doctor solves that. So we're a time tracking tool for remote teams. And then the second one is, what are the legal implications of going remote? And we've had clients that have been sued by governments, as an example, for people that are wintering in a country, and that country then says, well, you owe us payroll taxes for all of those employees that were wintering in that particular country. So this is only going to come up more and more, and you need a framework to be able to hire people legally. So we have 100 employees in 32 different countries around the world. We have subsidiaries in countries where we have a lot of workers, but in other countries where we don't have many workers, we don't have a subsidiary, and they are contractors under the law. We have a few people in Lagos, in Nigeria, as an example. Am I going to set up a subsidiary in Nigeria? No. Is Nigeria possibly going to come after me for payroll taxes? Theoretically, they could. I hope that they try. Good luck. But fundamentally, those are long-term problems that need to be solved if enterprise and large corporate wants to go remote. And we're seeing now, the data is very clear. Most projections put 50% of the U.S. workforce being remote by 2027. So this is definitely starting to ratchet up. Currently, right now, it's about 8% of the U.S. workforce. So it's going to ratchet up very quickly. And that company or that kind of problem needs to be solved in between those two time points.
So we've got, what are my folks doing? And can I do this without getting sued by the government of Nigeria? I'd imagine the government of Nigeria has a lot less to gain by suing your company of 130 compared to if they sue IBM, there's probably more juice from that squeeze.
Right. So they're going for who's the biggest fish that I can fry. If you have 10,000 employees in your company, you know, for any company that has 10,000 employees, they usually have internal counsel, and those lawyers flip out when they hear remote work. They think to themselves, what are the legal implications? Okay, this is $1 trillion worth of legal liability that's sitting on the floor here. What if there was a company that could basically assume all that legal liability for the company? And this is the thing that a lot of people don't understand when they look at enterprise. A lot of the times, the way you create value is simply by removing legal liability, which is funny because it doesn't really feel like it creates any value in the market. But for these lawyers, they'll say, listen, this thing has a risk at any one point to cost us $500 million a year on average. So if you can get rid of this for $100 million, then we've netted $400 million in net liability per year. So therefore, yes, we're going to take this deal.
So you're just expected value risk arbitrage at some point. And that's,
you're an insurance company.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's say that I'm at a fast-growing company right now. I'm co-located, and I'm thinking about this, that statistic of 2027, half my workforce could be remote. What do I need to do now to prepare to be more remote friendly? So co-located now, open to remote. What's my path to get there?
Are you the founder or an employee inside of the
organization? Let's say I'm an engineering manager. So I find that engineering gets to go remote first, just because hiring is much easier. And I wanna prepare. Let's say I'm a VP of engineering, so I've got some influence, but I'm not. I can't just make all of the decisions.
So first thing would be you need to chat with HR, and you need to get a remote work agreement in place. If you just Google running remote and the remote lawyer, there's a whole bunch of templates that we've collected through the remote lawyer, which is a law firm specifically for remote work. She has a whole bunch of them that are really great. So identify where those employees can work legally, and then what the KPIs and OKRs are going to be inside of that work agreement. Once you've got that deployed, I would not deploy your entire team remotely. I would start with, I personally would say, like one person, and run a 1 month experiment with that one single individual. You can compare that to your control group, which is everyone else that's still inside of an office, as an example, and figure out, have they held the same productivity gains of everyone else? You can use a tool like Time Doctor or any other tool fundamentally. You don't really, so like Time Doctor figures out the in-between of, let's say, a KPI, but as long as you have a very solid KPI in place, you should be all right. And then once that employee is holding at the same level, that's when I would start to expand. If they're not holding at that same level, then there seems to be a problem. And that's probably where we get into more the process documentation and the procedures of how to actually deploy a remote team.
So my first step is I go to search for a remote lawyer, get some templates, talk to HR, bring them, is this okay? I start a trial with one person and I set solid KPIs, and then I kind of expand from there. let's talk about the, I love that plan. What are some of the challenges I'm going to face with that first remote person? So I've got everyone co-located, first remote person, that feels like a hard transition. What are some things that I might be risking doing wrong?
Sure. Depending upon your company size, you're probably going to have a challenge of process documentation. So most companies that are, say, like, let's say sub 100 people, they generally don't have operational processes inside of their business. A remote company, however, has to act like a large business faster. So one of the critical parts is building operational procedures, documenting them, digitizing them, and then having them available for everyone to gain access to. So as an example, right now, I have the way that we booked this call, there's an operational process, at least for me and for Vaishali, who was the one that helped set all this stuff up, about how we reach out to somebody, what the conversation is going to be, how we create a booking. All of that stuff is documented, and it's in, you can put it into Google Docs as an example if you want something that's quick and easy and free. There are more complicated options like GitLab or Trainual, which is a purpose-built tool for process documentation inside of remote teams. A really great place to start is to go to about.gitlab.com/handbook, or just type in GitLab handbook. And GitLab, Dimitri, who is the CTO and co-founder of GitLab, he has a 3,200-page operational process guide on everything inside of GitLab. So if you need to know how a demo is done for GitLab, it's in there. If you need to know how to sign your emails properly, it's in there. If you need to know how many shares you're going to get when you join the company, it's all in there. It's 3,200 pages, and you can literally just fork it. So you can grab everything, you can copy it, and you can deploy it for your own company. And that will at least give you some ideas and some templates. And then you can start to edit that and have something in place. And then all of your devs come in and actually start editing all of those processes so that you have a clear understanding of what the heck you're going to do next. That, if you get over that, that's probably going to solve the vast majority of your issues as you scale. The second one is really connected to communication. So we're currently on Zoom right now. I'm seeing you, you see me. We generally try to move up the interaction chain as much as humanly possible. So I have a hierarchy of communication document, which basically means in person is better than video, video is better than audio, audio is better than instant messaging, and instant messaging is better than email. As you move up the chain, you have more focus, but you can also, you are not able to multitask, or you're not able to work on a particular task while you're getting an instant message versus us doing this call. So you need to be able to figure out what that right mix is. So if I've sent 10 instant messages through Slack, as an example, I almost immediately throw in a Zoom link and pull it directly to a video call so that we can work it out, so that I'm not getting another 20 instant messages for myself and the other 12 people that are in that channel. So you need to kind of work that out and make sure that you're understanding, number one, what's a good breakdown between distraction and productivity. And then secondarily, you need to be able to make sure that you keep the human context of remote communication in place. So even us having this face-to-face video chat that we're only getting on a podcast right now, I can see some of your nonverbal cues that allows me to have more richness inside of this conversation. So if I'm saying something and you're just looking at me kind of confused, but you're not saying anything, I can then change the way that I'm saying it. Whereas if I was on an audio call, I wouldn't get that same richness of interaction. So understanding all of those pieces is pretty critical. And then once you have that in place, you literally just start meeting with people on a regular basis. And that's the other part that a lot of people don't get, is just because someone's remote doesn't mean that they're ones and zeros on the other side of the planet. You need to meet with them. You need to talk to them. You need to talk to them about their KPIs so that they're staying accountable to that. You also need to make sure that their mental health is in place. Most remote workers, that's probably the biggest downside, is exposure to loneliness. So a lot of remote workers are more susceptible to loneliness than people in an office because you're just at home all day long. So really important to be able to keep that going. We've found, when we've done a little bit of psychometric testing, introversion is a real success factor for remote work. Usually extroverted people, they need to kind of go out from time to time. I'm slightly on the extroverted scale, and I usually need to go to a coffee shop or a co-working space maybe like one day a week just to kind of get that out. A lot of developers actually are more on the introverted side of the spectrum, and that is a huge advantage when you look at long-term remote work.
So I heard operational documentation and processes, having clear shared digital resources. Once we have that, we need to know about the hierarchy of communication. So climbing up the higher bandwidth, higher focus chain, rather than sending 30 back and forth Slack messages. And I need some strategy for dealing with loneliness, which is the biggest downside. When it comes to hiring, I've heard some people say that your first remote hire has to be someone who's done it before. Have you seen success with finding a more introverted person, or maybe introversion plus mitigation, with someone who hasn't been remote before for that first employee?
I would say probably hiring someone who has worked remotely before is definitely a huge advantage. I don't think I've necessarily asked that question before with clients, and that's an interesting question to ask. Yeah, I really couldn't answer that one properly, but I would say in general, someone having experience and or even someone connecting culturally to your perspectives is really important. So I'll give you an example. I was doing a short list of some candidates for a sales position about 2 years ago. And this guy had a fantastic resume, was in Palo Alto, closing deals left, right, and center. And when I did this meeting, I was very excited because he seemed like exactly the right candidate. But then about 15 minutes into the meeting and the interview, he said, well, I think that remote work is really stupid, and I don't think it's the future, and I don't think it's something that is going to work out long term. And I said, well, we're selling software for remote work. And he said, yeah, I can sell the software. I just don't believe it. Like, I don't think it's a good idea. And I said, okay, perfect. We're not aligned at all. You should probably find a job somewhere else. So now we actually, from that learning, we do a culture fit first on our intro interview before we actually go down to a short list for the direct manager. And we remove candidates that are perfectly fit on paper for the position, but because they don't align to our culture, we don't include them in short lists. And you'd think that initially that's kind of problematic, but I bet you long term, and we haven't really measured this quantifiably, our retention is probably way higher because people actually want to work remotely are going to be attracted to our positions, and people that aren't interested in working remotely are not attracted to our positions.
I love getting an alignment on mission and culture early. I think you highlighted the potential risk there. Like if we're wrong there, I think it's a little fuzzier. When you're getting concrete, so caring about remote work, that seems like a no-brainer. What else have you found to align with that culture early? What are some things that you must have in for your team?
At least for us, we have a quant first philosophy. So most decisions are moved to the next level through quantitative evidence, not through qualitative evidence. So you can feel on your gut through qualitative initially, but if you don't have quantitative data to be able to prove that this is the right direction to go, then we usually basically nix all of those ideas very quickly. And a lot of people don't think like that. A lot of people, I would probably say if you had 1,000 companies that thought the way that we did, and 1,000 companies that thought from their gut, the 1,000 that think quant probably are going to be more successful. You're going to have a higher degree that will continue to be alive in 10 years. But in the 1,000 that think just from their gut qualitatively, there are probably going to be a lower amount that succeed. But out of that subgroup, there's probably going to be like a Google and an Apple type of trajectory company, because those are the people that say, well, I think this is the way that the world should work. And I think I know something that everyone else doesn't know. And therefore, I'm going to continue to keep grinding at this idea until people realize it. And then they do realize it, and it's incredibly successful. But you can't really understand that without any quantitative data up front. And so for us, we usually make most of our moves based off of quantitative data. It's a lot more conservative way to move, but because we're all computer nerds, it's just the way that we're built. So that's another big one that I think we've actually had a lot of conflict in dealing with new hires because they'll come in and say, you know what? I think that things should run this way and I don't think they should run this way. And I would say, great, prove it. And very few people want to prove it quantifiably. And so therefore I say, well, until you can prove it quantifiably, you're not doing it. It's not getting done. And that frustrates a lot of people.
So you're going for the lower variance strategy, higher likelihood of success.
Exactly.
Maybe as many home runs, but you're going to survive.
Right. Would you rather have a $50 million company in 10 years or a $5 billion company in 10 years? Or would you rather have a 10% chance at a $50 million company or a 2% chance at a $5 billion company? And really, the actual dollars at the end of the day are probably the same, because having to build a $5 billion company, you actually need to do a lot more. You need to give away a lot more equity. You need to do a lot of other things that are actually going to get you to that target. And then you're also going to have to swing for the fences a lot more often, because you're going to have to figure out some type of opportunity space that no one has taken advantage of before, which requires you to think from a gut perspective. But if you want to, like right now, I just came back from Dublin in Ireland, and there's like an Uber for Ireland out there. Right. Because you always have to, interesting now that the market is kind of going in the reverse, where all of these secondary markets end up building like the Uber or Lyft of Indonesia or Ireland or Egypt or whatever. And a much more solid win, a win that has a higher chance of success, is just doing that, copying someone else's technology and knowing, okay, well, I know it's working here and I know the variables and I know how to actually replicate this type of technology, but that doesn't take you into the maximum innovation space that other companies will take, and they'll, less of them will succeed, but the ones that do succeed will win big time.
So I think this slider is a thing I see product teams have, product development teams, engineering teams have to kind of pick a spot. Because if you want to optimize the 42 shades of blue, like Google infamously did, that's a very different mindset than we're going to take this swing because we want to change this. We want to make this crazy belief true. How do you actually, like, do you have interview questions? Are we talking multiple choice? Is it psychometrics? How do you figure out where someone is on that slider?
We do a little bit of psychometric testing for sure. And we basically have a culture fit interview. So we'll ask questions like, do you like working remotely? Have you worked remotely before? We ask a question, give me an example of something that you do outside of work that is quite interesting that you would like to share. So we had a job interview that I was looking at yesterday. This guy rode his bicycle across Canada, and he did that for like 3 months. And that was an interesting thing, because we're looking for people that are driven in an extraordinary way to kind of do weird things. And that seems to work quite well with what we're doing, because remote work, even though in the tech sphere is kind of almost adoptable now, is like, I was just at a conference and I asked who has remote team members, and 60% of the audience put their hand up, which was very inspiring. But if I went to your average person on the street, probably, well, less than 8% would put their hand up. So remote is still something that's quite weird, and we're trying to basically see who is at least okay with it, and then who is also doing extraordinary things that were done from themselves, was self-motivated, because
intrinsically,
right? Because remote workers, they have to work a lot more independently than workers in an office. They have to be self-motivated. If you are just left to your own devices and you're not being actively pushed by someone to accomplish the task, usually we'll end up just terminating those people after a very short amount of time, because they are not, it's a lot more labor intensive to push them remotely than in person. And some people actually see that as a huge advantage. So the personality type that says, like, don't bug me, I actually know exactly what I want to do, those are the people that we want to get.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help high-growth engineering teams find hidden gems in their hiring pool so they can hire faster with less engineering effort. What's a hidden gem? Take this candidate. For the sake of anonymity, let's call him Bobby. Bobby spent 15 years as a grocery department manager at Walmart. If you looked at his resume, you would see 15 years of retail experience and no tech degree. Sure, he took a course at a coding boot camp, but most companies would still throw Bobby's resume in the trash. Now, Bobby's a full-stack engineer. In our work simulation, he converted a back-end algorithm from outline to working code that passed all the tests. It was well-structured. He also debugged an API based on limited information and was a great communicator back to his technical colleague and a non-technical colleague. He was in the top 10%. This is someone that absolutely would have been passed over. According to his resume, he shouldn't have this job. Luckily, there was a better way. Bobby outperformed candidates with a 4-year computer science degree and years of development experience. Other companies overlooked Bobby in favor of candidates with the right credentials. Our customer was able to get a great engineer without having to compete with the big tech companies. As a result, they hired more developers in their first 60 days with Woven than they did in the previous year combined. Even better, they spent a fraction of what a headhunter would have cost them. If you want to see this for yourself, we'll build you a tailored demo. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo. So I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about time tracking a little bit. So I'm going to be a little skeptical. So my skepticism is I use time tracking on myself because I know that I am this kind of weak-willed, I have a Chrome extension to block Twitter after a certain amount of time each day. Like I know for myself that I need these bars and I like to know, but I'm terrified of the idea of asking someone on my team to install tracking and show me that tracking. So I feels like a conflict to me. How have you seen tech companies that might have that same conflict get good usage out of time tracking?
So I think that what we really see Time Doctor as is the kind of secret backdoor towards remote work. So a lot of people that are thinking about implementing remote work agreements, they are very resistant towards doing it without some type of accountability measure. And just Time Doctor has been one of the easiest ways to be able to solve that problem for them. Now, outside of that, you'd probably be interested in knowing that number one, everyone in the company uses our product. I'm actually tracking time right now on this particular call. And that also allows me to know the direct ROI every single podcast that I've done. So we collect all this data and then we know, well, it cost us $62 to do this podcast and we generated $380 from this podcast, as an example. But then secondarily to that, what it also allows me to do is optimize my own personal productivity. So we really discuss it in the sense of productivity as opposed to seeing what someone is doing with their time. So right now, anyone in the company can actually see my data, and we allow everyone else inside of the company to see each other's data. And then at the end of the day, it's about a productivity advantage as opposed to necessarily working the same amount of hours. I think that there is a disconnect right now in understanding just because you're working longer doesn't mean you're getting anything done at all. We have a KPI inside of our sales team, which is how many dollars did you generate per hour? That is how actually people win their sales bonus. So we don't talk about how many sales you closed because we realized this was actually creating a really negative feedback loop where people were working 240 hours in a month and they were totally burnt out. And within 9 months, they'd be burnt out and they'd want to quit. They'd have a whole bunch of money, but they'd quit. And we realized a much better work-life balance was let's try to optimize for dollars closed per hour. And that completely changed the way that people work inside of the company. So we look for the crucial variable, like the thing that makes the worker more productive, not necessarily the variable that makes the worker work longer. Because when you look inside of where like the 9-to-5, 5-day work week came from, and in China, it's the 9-to-6, 6-day work week as an example, where that all comes from is from the Industrial Revolution. And developers didn't exist during the Industrial Revolution. So you need to actually treat them very differently. We've seen a lot of data inside of Time Doctor to show that they're almost perfectly aligned with creative writing. So a developer acts almost exactly like a creative writer. And creative writers don't do a 7-day, 9-to-5 work week. What they do is they will usually remove all distractions. They'll get into a flow state and they might work for like 18 hours, and then they might not work for 2 days, and then they might work for 7 or 8 hours, and then they may not work for a day. So we've realized that that's the optimal way to actually work with somebody outside of direct check-ins, obviously, which is something that we do for every single team member and make sure that they're accountable for that. But outside of that, we don't care where they work or when they work, as long as they're doing the work in the most optimal way possible. And the way that we prove that is through our time doctor data.
I think there are a lot of people on Twitter that would be very upset that someone is allowed to work an 18-hour day. It seems like there's a lot of conformism on, like, if you're not working the normal day, you're driving other people to work more. I found that to be true with myself when I was writing more code, is I definitely had streaks where I was just on it and other days where I wasn't.
Well, when you think about a writer, when they're in flow state focus, you should, like, if I could engineer the perfect kind of developer work experience, if I knew you were locked into flow state and I could have you in that state as long as possible, I would do whatever it takes. Like, do you need food? I will deliver it. Do you need, you know, a massage therapist to be able to, like, rub your shoulders while you're still working? I will do it. Anything to extend that amount of time, because you'd be blown away at how much just junk in terms of a developer's day is just it's no good at all, right? And when you get into that right mindset, those spurts of productivity, that might be 10 to 20% of your workday, but it might account for 80% of the code that actually ships. So why not focus just on that?
That feels right to me. We talk about focus blocks of time. FBOTS is like the true north for productivity. So one thing I've seen you say, that the biggest problem in building a remote team is finding great talent. I think finding talent is hard. My number one pitch for remote work is typically that hiring is, especially for developers, is 10x easier, if not more. I've had hundreds of conversations, and there are three companies I've talked to that are hiring a significant amount of developers who don't feel like it's a bottleneck, and all three of those companies are remote. Is there a conflict in what you said and what I said there?
A bottleneck between the ability for people to be able to work remotely and their overall success connected to it?
So these are fully remote companies. They're able to hire great developers that fit their goals as fast as they roughly need, versus that is not something you hear people say that are not remote.
Okay. So first step is, I think, so Andreas Klinger gave me this statistic, who was the CTO of Product Hunt and is currently the head of remote at AngelList.
Yeah, he was a Postgres guest. He had really great insight on remote work.
Yeah, he was telling me that 80% of new developers, so not corporate, but new developers in Palo Alto are going remote, which seems insane to me. That number seems wacky because they're just so expensive, developers in the Valley. I would say, I mean, the tactical advantage that we have is we just hired someone who got fifth place in the Facebook hackathon. Global hackathon. And he is in Bangladesh. And he got an offer from Google. He got an offer from Facebook in the high six-figure range. Actually, sorry, mid six-figure range. And he's working for us for the mid five-figure range because he wants to stay in Bangladesh. He does not want to move. And in Bangladesh, he's probably making, you know, $800,000 a year in Bangladeshi lifestyle dollars. But he's able to stay with his family. He's able to support his entire family. He's very happy to remain there. And there are so many of these other opportunities that are popping up for remote workers. So as of right now, we see it as a huge strategic advantage where we're taking advantage of all of the cream that exists outside of San Francisco and New York. And so by being able to take advantage of that cream, we get, you know, better lines of code written per dollar than anyone else. It's an advantage for us. I think it will absolutely be an advantage for other companies. I think it's going to last for another 18 to 36 months before those advantages kind of evaporate. Two forces is, number one, there's a lot of companies that are doing it now. So that cream is getting thinner and thinner. And then secondarily is the price of your, like, middle America developer that you can hire for $65,000 to $85,000, that middle America developer will end up going up to 100,000 and then 120 and then probably 140 very quickly. There's a interesting phenomenon that's happening right now in San Francisco where people will go and work in San Francisco, then they'll negotiate a remote work agreement, and then they will move out of San Francisco. And they're getting a San Francisco salary, but they're living in Ohio, so their cost of living is, you know, 30% of what it would be in San Francisco. And the actual employers love it even more because their retention is way higher. The average tenure in the Valley is 9 months for a tech position, which is insane.
That is insane.
Yeah, our net retention right now is 94% for 100 headcount per year. So, you know, that's just a world that I don't even live in, where you would have to completely rotate, let's say 60-70% of your headcount every year. That seems insane to me, but that's what these companies have to deal with. We just don't have those problems, which is another big strategic advantage.
So go to San Francisco, move back to Dayton and cash that fat check and keep your job.
No joke. That is awesome. Like that's what, if you are a developer now that has the skills, get your job for one of these companies, negotiate a remote work agreement, and then get the hell out of that place. It is going to put a hole in your pocket. I have a friend of mine, he was working for Shopify and he was making about 80-ish thousand Canadian. And then he moved to Palo Alto and worked for Netflix for 260. And he said there was less money in his pocket in Palo Alto at 260 than there was at 80 for Shopify. So that doesn't seem to calculate for me.
I believe
it. That works. So get the 260 and then leave and move back to Canada.
My guest today has been Leon Martin. Leon, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Liam for sharing his experience with us. Here are a couple takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, transitioning from co-located to remote engineering teams is doable with a plan. The first step that Liam recommends is to get a formal remote work agreement. You can Google running remote and the remote lawyer, and you'll get some options. So this is an agreement between the company and the employee. Then go to HR, set clear KPIs and goals, and start with a trial remote team. So start with one person. If you set clear KPIs and goals, you'll be able to show success by having that person hit those KPIs. One of the key challenges to that first remote employee succeeding is documentation. Most companies sub about 100 people don't really have great operational process documents. If you're going to succeed remote, you need to build that documentation for that person. Liam's pro tip for bootstrapping that documentation is to go to GitLab, find their handbook, which is huge, 3,400 pages, covers about everything you'd want to know as a default. Fork that handbook and start whittling it down to just the processes you need. Another key point is to communicate about the hierarchy of communication. In person is better than video, higher bandwidth. Video is better than audio. Audio is better than IM, and IM is better than email. It's important to keep that hierarchy in mind to train your co-located team on how to communicate with that remote person and vice versa. And once we've done all that, we still need to meet that remote worker in person on a regular basis. Could be quarterly, could be every 6 months. There, we need to cover KPIs and we need to talk about mental health. Loneliness is a big problem in remote work, especially for folks who haven't done it before. Number two, the recipe for your first remote hire is different than your 90th. According to Andreas Klinger, head of remote at AngelList, 80% of all new developers are going remote first. If we haven't hired our first remote dev yet, we're probably going to have to eventually. When we're looking for that first remote hire, past remote work and effectiveness is good, but it is very possible to hire a first-time remote worker. One big predictor of success is introversion, and you can test this with any common Big Five, Ocean type test. The blog 538 has an excellent one of these. So introversion versus extroversion. Introversion is actually a predictor of remote success. These are folks that maybe don't need that in-person time as much to charge them up. They actually can get energy from being alone, which is something you get plenty of as a remote worker. Beyond possibly introversion, culture fit is doubly important, especially mission alignment. This is someone that's going to need to be intrinsically motivated. This is, if it's insert dollar, get motivation, it's going to be much, much harder here. So if they really care about your mission, they really align with your culture, they're going to be intrinsically motivated and much more successful. You want someone that might utter the sentence, "Don't bug me, I want to get work done." Thanks again to Liam for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.